Everyone hits a bump in the road. What do you do with it? Be inspired as we explore the ways people experience, navigate, and manage the ups and downs and twists and turns in this road trip called life.
Malcolm Grissom was born to be on stage, but when a virus caused him to go into a coma and lose much of his ability to speak and to move, he found himself utterly lost. His very identity had been stripped away. But step by step, he learned to walk and then to run. And then one day, on stage, he discovered the power of laughter. And from that moment on, the rest was history. Today, Malcolm is a stand-up comic and a speaking coach. His story will move you to tears and then have you on your feet cheering him on. Malcolm, welcome to Bump in the Road. If you would, tell us your story.
I sure would. Thanks, Pat. Yes. Once upon a time, there was a little boy and it is like that. It is like a fairy tale beginning. I was born on stage. I was born in San Francisco, in front of my entire neighborhood. My entire neighborhood was watching as I was born in the backseat of a very tiny, tiny little sports car. My dad said I was really special because I was born and conceived in the same place. I just hope that I wasn't in front of my entire neighborhood that I was conceived. That would have been weird. So I was in the public eye, you know, the entire time, and the entire part of my, forgive me, I'm going to like forget words and jumble words and things like that. So I was in the public eye during my entire childhood. I then grew up later to become starring in my first play when I was 7. My mom took me to see her in The Music Man when she was 5. And I went on then to star in my own play when I was 7. And I just loved improv, and I was happy and lucky and making people laugh and smile. And I loved to do that, play and run around. And then when I was 9 years old, I woke up in the hospital bed. And I heard the doctor tell my parents, "Your son has Reye's syndrome. It had permanently attacked his brain and liver, and he may be paralyzed for the rest of his life." I didn't know quite what to do. I was 9 at the time. But there was something inside me that just said, "No, this is not going to happen." And I just fought like heck. And I worked with my therapist and within about 6 months, I was then able to at least stand on my own and balance a little bit, you know, wobbly, but I could balance and I could grunt, not even as clear as that. And that's, of course, when my mom said, okay, you could walk and talk. It's time for you to go back to school. Because she was the type to push, and she wanted, well, she was a narcissist, and she was an alcoholic, so she wanted, everything was up to her, and she was really selfish. Everything revolved around her. She was ready then for me to leave the house so she didn't have to deal with her sick little boy anymore. And so she put me back into school.
Well, I need to interrupt, but how did you feel about that? Because at 9, hopefully, you know, you're kind of more present moment than we are as adults. I mean, how did you look ahead? Did you worry about the future? Were you just trying to survive in the moment? How did you feel about what was happening to you?
Well, in the hospital, I didn't feel much. I was in a coma for 24 hours. And luckily, I was lucky and I came out of that coma and I was comatose. But I was not able to talk or really, I mean, the most I could do, I could move my finger maybe like that. But everything else was, you know, very, very stiff. And I was just really scared. I didn't know what was going on. I had lost my identity. I lost who I was. You know, before I knew who I was a happy, joy, lovable Malcolm who everybody loved. I was, you know, in school, I went to a, so by this time, I moved to Hawaii, and I lived in a very small farming town, and everyone in the school knew me, and so in the fourth grade, I was the life of the fourth grade. I was the joke writer, the jokester. I was the class clown. I was the active little boy, the active little bumblebee, if you will. And now all of a sudden, I'm just the blob. And so I really didn't know. I had really lost my identity, so I was really scared. So that was the overall emotion.
How did you move ahead?
I moved ahead. I think initially it was something about me. It was a spiritual feeling. I don't want to get religious. I'm not religious, but I am very spiritual. It was a spiritual feeling. It was an intuitive feeling. God said to me, "You're not done. You're not leaving. It's not your time. You have much to do." And so that was the initial push that got me started. And then it was other people as well. People like my therapist, my mother a little bit, my therapist, a lot of therapy. speech therapy and physical therapy, of course. And then my stepfather, because when I got back into school, I was, as I said, it was a very small town. And so everyone knew me. And so they knew this bright star in the fourth grade. And in the fifth grade, I come back and I'm a 10-year-old walking Frankenstein. And I'm still afraid of who I am. I still don't know. And the kids, my friends, don't know. And they're scared. And I'm sure you know that kids, especially when they're scared, are mean. They don't know how to react except to be mean. And so that's when a lot of the external bullying came into place in my life. And that's also when there was a lot of internal bullying, because then I was confused, but now I was doubly confused because here are my friends who are now my enemies. And
that just turned your world totally, totally upside down.
It did. It really did. And so much so. And so for about 2 years, I hid from the world, really. My only friend was my therapist, the school counselor. I went to the counselor's office every day. And then when I went home, but as I said, because of my home life, because of the way that it was structured, no one, my stepfather tried not to be at home as much as he could. And my mother didn't really give me much love and support at that point. So I was really in my own cocoon, my own world. And it was my stepfather who encouraged me to try some of the things that I had tried before my illness. And so I went out and I tried for the T-ball team because I was very active and I loved to be active and run. And I loved to play baseball. So I tried the T-ball team. And the coach was, no, you can't join this team. You're a liability. We can't have you. Sorry. So I went and tried out for the track team in my town in Honokaw. And again, the coach was, no, I'm sorry. You're a liability. My trip. I'm sorry, we can't have you. I was really, really destroyed. I didn't quite know what to do at that point. But my stepfather says to me, look, if you want to run, you should run. You don't need anyone's permission to run. You don't need anyone's permission to do what you want to do. And so every day I started going to the track and just started shuffling and then eventually running, jogging, you know, and I'm just loosening my body a little bit. And my body started to come back to normal slowly. Well, I wouldn't say normal, but it started to come back to where I had more control over my body. And eventually the track coach saw that and said, "You know, Malcolm, I was wrong. You have a lot of heart and determination, and that's what we need on this team." And allowed me on the team. So it was, so to make a short answer, very, very long. the initial motivation was really God, and my intuition. And then it was a lot of other people.
Wow. You know, one of the things I'm fascinated by how some people can come through really difficult circumstances and others just fold. They can't do it. And I think that I listening to your story, and I've heard parallels in other stories, I think that some people have this spark within them. There is something within them that pushes them in a way that a lot of people just don't push themselves. And, you know, you had support from outside, but you really found it within yourself to do this.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah.
So fast forward, how did you end up on stage?
Well, because of my stepfather's encouragement, I joined the speech and drama club in high school. And that led to a performance of an original short play, if you can call it that. It was a short script written by our teacher, Mrs. Saito. And I was still in Honoka'a, and Honoka'a is a elementary and high school combined. So in our assemblies, there were like 300 kids. And one day we did this, we were tasked to do this performance of this original script. It was called The Mystery of the Lost Newspaper. And I was the newspaper boy, and I had this line. It's only six words, but I was really, really nervous because I was going to be in front of 300 kids, and this was really the first time that I was in front of more than 35 kids at a time. And I was also going to be in front of the groups that were bullying me at the time. And so I was really nervous. In the performance, we stood in a line facing this auditorium. So it was a gymnasium. We stood in a line in the middle of the gymnasium. We were in a straight line, and one by one, each person stepped up to the mic to give their line. And when it was my turn, I got through my six lines or my six words perfectly. And I was so excited that I laughed and a long line of snot shot out from the ground and then right back in like a snot yo-yo.
Oh.
The auditorium was laughing. Entire auditorium was laughing. I was kind of embarrassed, but I was like, yeah, I meant for that to happen. Because everyone was laughing. And then after the performance, Mrs. Saito comes to me and she says, there are some fans that want to come and say something to you. And it turned out to be this gang that bullied me the most, who were my best friends in the fourth grade. They were my biggest bullies in the fifth grade.
Did you forgive them?
They forgave me. I mean, I forgave them because they came up to me after that performance and they said, wow, you are so funny. We really love that snot bit. You are a master. And we then became friends. We then became friends again. And I recognized, that's when I recognized the power of laughter. And once I recognized the power of laughter in that way, then, as I said, I was, in my childhood, I was always this actor. So I'm a born actor. Born to be on stage, born to be in front of people, and now I understand the power of laughter in that and connecting people. And so that really motivated me to become a stand-up comedian. And that's the next journey in my life. So that took me into college. So that was my motivation there.
That's astonishing. Today, you are both working as a stand-up comic, correct? And also helping other people become speakers.
I am a keynote speaker. Yeah, I am a keynote speaker myself and a speaker coach, correct? Yes, I am. I help people get in touch with their... They're funny. I help people find they're funny for several reasons, for several areas. Right now, my focus is with business leaders, helping them find their funny because funny makes more money. Funny makes more money, right?
Well, it makes people relatable.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it does that. It does that. And it, well, yeah, it makes money. It makes people relatable. People like you based on how you make them feel when they're with you. If you make someone feel safe, because laughter is very safe, if you make someone feel good because laughter releases the hormones like endorphins, the feel-good hormones, it releases oxytocin, serotonin, and on and on and on. Because laughter has these health benefits, it increases the immune system, it increases your oxygen intake. No one feels worse after they laugh. They only feel better after they laugh because laughter has all these benefits. When it's used by a salesperson, whether they're speaking or whether they are writing copy, marketing copy, then people are naturally going to connect to that and feel good around that person or product. And these one-time clients are going to then become fans because they like how you make them feel.
Absolutely. You know, it's also experiential. When you laugh, you share a moment with somebody. Mm-hmm. And it's a really good moment and it kind of imprints on you. And that doesn't go away.
Yep.
Laughter is definitely your friend. So yeah. Do you look for instances, funny incidents that are kind of self-deprecating for people to tell, or a joke in general? How do you, what brand of laughter do you try to put together for people? Or do you try to have them dig out of their lives?
Yeah, I'm not a joke writer. I mean, if someone comes to me to learn stand-up comedy, that's different. That's a different story. But with speakers and in business, it's more about finding out who they are and their humor, their sense of humor that's dug deep and bringing that out. So it's not necessarily a joke. In fact, it rarely is. Because people aren't usually, when they're in business and they want to do business, one or two jokes, maybe they can stomach that, but people don't want to necessarily do business with someone who's joking all the time, right?
Oh, no, no.
So it's much more about finding their humor, their authentic humor, and bringing that out. So it's less jokey. In my comedy, I do deprecating humor. That's really the start of my comic journey. My comedic journey is the use of deprecating humor. And, but with other people, I look at wordplay, look at a lot of exaggeration, just look at silliness and playfulness in general, and really who they are, and where they're coming from.
Given what you've been through, who are you today? How would you describe yourself?
I am... I'm a vessel. I'm a vessel with a lot of knowledge. I'm a vessel to help people to create atmospheres, safe atmospheres for people in this, in my vicinity, and then in my own way in the world. I am constantly, a vessel. I say a vessel because I'm constantly learning new information and constantly filling myself up and helping people in that way. And that, when I say that way, helping people in many ways that they need. And I am someone here to to do God's work, to spread love and understanding and empathy, and to do my best to leave a legacy and to make a change, any change in this world and in the future.
One final question. If you could rewrite your story, would you?
No. I wouldn't. Who I am and what I've gone through makes me exactly who I am. I very often wish that I could talk faster. I very often wish that I didn't have these moments, these occasional moments of, how should I say it? Brain farts. They're brain farts, really. I have brain farts, very often brain farts, because I'm an old man, and old men fart a lot. And I know that as I get older, not only will I have my brain farts, but then I'll have senior moments, and then I'll be losing a lot of things. And I wish that I didn't have those moments at times, but it's learning how to, it's learning how to speak with the rhythm that I have now. That process really helps me to do what I can do now, which is work with other people and really learn them and how they can best deal with, how they can best bring out their humor and find their humor and find their stories and change their stories. So it's going through my struggles. It's going through the continued struggles and brain damage that I have. That is really a tool that makes me not only unique, but makes me powerful in doing what I'm doing. So no, I wouldn't change it at all.